Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, the radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, I get out to Montpelier as frequently as I can, and one of the things I enjoy most when I'm there is when I get invited to some big fancy conference with big fancy people with big eggheads. You know the types, the people who want to talk about the deep issues, the big issues. We sit together and we have ourselves a big think. Sometimes we deliberate. Sometimes we come up with ideas that no one's ever thought of before. And that's the sort of thing that you need to do from time to time. You need to step back from the day-to-day. You need to step back from a particular historical context. You need to ask yourself, what are we trying to do in our constitutional democracy? Are we doing it well? And if not, how do we fix it? Well, recently one of those conferences took place at the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. It was called a Conference on Deliberative Democracy, or you might more commonly call it one on political participation. And the question we addressed ourselves to was, what were common folk thinking of back in the 1780s, back as we started getting ready to have our Constitutional Convention and then ultimately adopt the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? What did common folk think? What did women think? What did African Americans think? All the people who were not present at the Constitutional Convention. This was done under the auspices of the Kettering Foundation, a great group out of Ohio that is very interested in such matters. There were a number of very learned and interesting participants. One of them in particular, a fellow by the name of Brad Rourke, agreed to sit down and talk with me about some of these intriguing and deep issues. So, Brad Rourke, who are you and what do you do?
It's great to be here, Stuart. Really appreciate having the chance to talk. Mm-hmm. I'm a president of the Manakee Circle Group. We're a consulting firm that adds capacity to civic organizations. And we have an expertise in doing work in deliberative democracy and civic participation.
And that's what we did just yesterday. We're here at Montpelier, of course, talking today. And yesterday we had a group meeting, well, I guess most meetings are with groups, with the sponsored by the Kettering Foundation, right? And that was the focus.
That's right. I'm a senior associate with the Kettering Foundation is one of the hats I wear. And the Kettering Foundation is a research foundation that studies how democracy can work. And so no better place than here at in the Constitutional Village of Montpelier, where the Constitution was born, and first imagined to work on issues of democracy. And we studied yesterday in what I thought was a fascinating meeting, the kinds of concerns that might have been on the minds of ordinary people in the late 1780s when it was beginning to be clear that we needed to get together to think about how are we going to govern this nascent nation of ours?
Yeah, and one of the focuses of the group was to try to bring in voices that might otherwise not have been heard. I mean, Most anybody who's paid attention to it is probably aware of the basic Jeffersonian position, the basic Hamiltonian position, and that sort of thing, and many of the perspectives of those who were at the convention. But there are a lot of unrepresented groups, notably women, notably African Americans, even people who are economically marginalized. And I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of the discussion, is trying to figure out what these people's perspectives might have been had they been allowed to participate better.
That's exactly right, and it's interesting the parallels to now. I mean, if you think about the voices that are marginalized in current political discourse, they're the same. They're in many cases they're the same ones. The voices of ordinary people, people who are not leaders, who don't write letters to the editor, who don't pen op-eds, who don't have the ear of the folks who trod the hallways of power. And so we were trying to imagine. Yesterday, imagine a farmer in a town or a group of folks at a tavern. these are people who aren't going to go be, you know, chosen to go to the Constitutional Convention. And yet they're the voices that that the delegates eventually are going to have to answer to when the Constitution needs to be ratified. And so we were trying to imagine, so what are the concerns of these folks? And what was interesting to me in our conversation yesterday was this interesting dynamic. We had a bunch of experts in the room, experts in constitutional theory and study. And just as today, when you get experts in a room and you ask them the question, so what would ordinary people think about issue X, whatever the issue is that they're an expert on? Mm-hmm. The first answer is usually they wouldn't think about it, and it takes too much knowledge for them to even begin to think about it. They're not qualified. And the off-the-cuff answer in the room, as I recall, was essentially when we posited this, what are the concerns of a farmer? Someone has said to a farmer or a group of folks in a tavern, hey, there's talk of a convention of some sort to get together to think about what we ought to do. What do you think? The off-the-cuff answer was, well, they would have nothing to say. they're worried about subsistence, making ends meet, just living, and they would have no say in the matter. And then, of course, as you push on that and you think about it, those initial responses sort of fall to the wayside, and you begin to realize, and I think I'm remembering our conversation correctly, that at some point you begin to realize that, you know, even someone who's subsisting has aspirations, has concerns when faced with the notion of potential government intrusion. Are taxes going to go up? Am I going to have to... We're talking about making a country. Am I going to have to garrison troops suddenly? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at the time, you know, we had experience with those sorts of things. Am I going to be able to sell my goods down the river without paying, you know, a tax to Maryland, and a tax to Virginia, just to get it through the, you know, down the way? It was interesting to me, the dynamic of unpeeling sort of the practical wisdom of ordinary people. And
I'm glad you mentioned that, Brad, because I think all throughout history, the stratification of society and the concentration of power in a relatively small group of people, that's a persistent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been throughout, and we like to think of ourselves in this country as being a liberal democracy where people really do have a say in their government. And yet, even here, even where I think we had a room full of well-intentioned people yesterday, even here at the home of the Constitution, the first response is, well, you know, they're just common folks. Everybody don't understand this stuff. Leave it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is always going to be a problem. And I think perhaps more and more so, to the extent that, we become a more segregated society, segregated by class, segregated mm-hmm. by education. Mm-hmm. People have the freedom now to choose very carefully where they're going to live, and they tend to go with like-minded people, mm-hmm. more or less the same income levels, the whole gated community phenomenon. And there's less and less connection on a daily basis between these groups. And citing my own example, my grandfather only finished the fourth grade. Mm. He was a very important figure in my youth. My father was the first in our family ever to go to college, and it's still one of the relatively rare members in our extended family from his generation. He used the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And so I felt a connection when I was growing up to people who were very much in the working class or the lower working class,
right,
in terms of their status and their income and all the rest of it. I don't know that my own children have that connection.
Mm-hmm.
Our family sort of represents the distancing of those the haves from the haves not.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder to what extent that problem's simply going to get worse with time.
Well, I think it's likely to get worse, worse places a value on it, and that in a way that it may or may not be accurate, but it'll be more intensified. Let's put it that way.
Right.
You know, that phenomenon where we sort ourselves into like-minded groups is well documented. Bill Bishop wrote a book called The Big Sort that was one of the first ones to sort of get that idea out there. But
technology assists it because I mean now you can go to only those websites where mm-hmm. like-minded people gather. You certainly can watch only television channels where people agree with you. Mm-hmm. It becomes an echo chamber. Yeah.
But even more powerfully, though, it's tempting to say say technology, communications technology, are to blame. I would say they're an intensifier. But even more profoundly, we're sorting ourselves physically. So, as you mentioned, the gated communities, even non-gated communities, we sort ourselves so that we live and work and interact among people who are pretty much like us. And we organize our lives so we don't have to interact with people who are unlike us. And, you know, so that happens. And I think in yours and my generations, you know, we do embody that shift from a relatively immobile to a highly mobile society. So people go where they want to go, and people want to be with like-minded folk.
They certainly do. In fact, probably I'll tell another personal anecdote at the risk of boring people, but one of the first dates I went on with my wife, we went to a Springsteen concert in South Philadelphia, sort of his hometown almost. And it was a large and very eclectic crowd. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I could see how, you know, it got a little rowdy. There was a little scalping activity, that sort of thing. It had that sort of freewheeling atmosphere. And, you know, once or twice we're walking around, could feel a little bit uncomfortable here or there. And we noticed another couple that sort of looked and dressed sort of like we did. And that couple immediately came over and stood next to us in this crowd. And I was kind of smiling to myself. And the phenomenon was confirmed when mm-hmm. the young woman in the couple looked at us and said, "I'm so glad there's some other regular people here."
Right.
I almost burst out laughing. Regular people.
We're all regular people.
We're all
right?
regular people yeah. because we define what's regular in terms yeah. of ourselves yeah. and the people we know, and everyone else is the other. And mm-hmm. I think that's a phenomenon all of us are familiar with, regardless mm-hmm. of where we are in the spectrum. And that then becomes a problem because only the regular people at the top of the heap or toward the top of the heap really participate actively in
right.
governing.
And that tends to solidify, that sort solidifies existing stratifications. And, you know, there was recently a study or a report that I can't cite it. I wish I could. But it pointed out that, and I believed it, that there's actually more social mobility in Europe, in European nations, than there is in the United States of America, which is counterintuitive to our self-image.
Certainly, yeah. Racial algebra and all that.
Exactly. That you're more likely to remain in whatever class you are here in the U.S. than you are in Britain or other European nations, which is fascinating to me that there's no tradition of getting stuck here in the U.S. In fact, there's a tradition of the opposite, but we've actually arranged things so that we're pretty much stuck.
That's very interesting. Now, before I ask you what seems to me the next logical question, which is what is the solution, I'm actually going to ask a preliminary question.
Mm.
Is that a problem? I mean, we had a bunch of elites who came together in 1787. They cobbled together a pretty darn good constitution. It's lasted pretty well for the last mm-hmm. 200 years. So what's wrong with, you know, the meritocracy? What's wrong with the select people who have virtue and education, as Madison or Hamilton or Washington or Jefferson might have said, simply kind of benevolently ruling the rest of society? What's wrong with that?
You know, in a definitional sense, you could say, well, there's nothing actually wrong with that, so long as the outcomes are decent. We've got a framework developed by elites that has input mechanisms for the people in the form of their biennial election of members of the House and then later after amendment to members of the Senate and the President. So, in one sense, you could say, well, it's all good. However, I would argue that that it is a problem, actually, and it's a problem in two ways. One is the obvious. They may both be obvious, but one obvious problem is that, well, to the extent that the elites get out of touch, get corrupt, because as we know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That the outcomes can begin to not be the ones that that we want as a people, and so that's one obvious.
So an elite problem. Tends to simply become corrupt as time goes on.
It may, yeah, it may. I'm not actually saying it tends to, but it can. Mm-hmm. And once that begins to happen, there are a few corrective mechanisms. If it's an elite echo chamber, there are a few corrective mechanisms in place.
Other than revolution and the terror and the guillotine and
right,
all the rest. That's not desirable for anybody.
Which is the symptom of breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
That's what revolution is. So that's one obvious problem. Another problem, less obvious, able to be figured out pretty quickly, though, is that our form of self-rule depends on the participation of not of elites, but of the people, and so in that sense, the word citizen is a normative word that doesn't just mean someone with papers, but actually means someone who accepts the mantle and the responsibility of self-rule, mm-hmm. and accepts the responsibility to make choices together and to do things. And to the extent
that... The
civic-minded pillar of society, and not in a high and mighty kind of way, but the one who takes it upon... It takes as their duty to show up at town meeting, to talk to my member of the city council and say, I'd really rather that the bridge weren't on my land, or mm-hmm. weren't down this road here, or we should put the dam somewhere else because it'll be bad for this species of fish, or people to speak up and to step forward and be on task forces and take an active part in governing. And to the extent that we sort ourselves into elites and participators and the non-participators, we lose that sense of we lose that robust sense of self-rule. And so at some point, in some sense, it's always ever been thus, and folks who are just worried about subsistence are really, they spend most of their time surviving, and that's the way we are in life, many of us. However, the phenomenon of viewing government as something that I consume has come to the fore, and it's gone along with this big sort. So somewhere around the mid-70s, we began as citizens to see ourselves as consumers of government. And government as providing a service. And there are services that government obviously provides, police, fire, etc. But at some point, the relationship between me and my government became one of me consuming its goods. So government began to worry about, am I providing customer service? Do we have happy constituents? And...
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. As you say, government does provide services, and you certainly mm-hmm. want to keep your constituents happy, but I think the subtext there is that that's all people think of government.
Right. And
they don't think of it as something that they participate in.
Exactly.
As well.
In a system where we rule ourselves, government is actually more than that. Government is the choices we make together. And the rules we develop together about how we're going to interact with one another. And if I see myself as having no role in our public life, as something over there that I consume or I don't think about if possible, then that's the extent to which you have the possibility of the government and the elites getting further and further and further from the people.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where I'm speaking with Brad Rourke, a very interesting man whom I met at a recent Kettering Foundation conference at Montpelier. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more to Brad about things like political participation and maybe even ethics. Stay tuned.
In this country, it belongs to folks like me and you. So let the voice of freedom sing out through this land. This is our country. From the East Coast to the West Coast, down the Dixie Highway, back home. This is our country.
It's the Constitutional Quiz! Kelly is here. We're so excited. Thanks for coming, Kelly.
Thank you for having me. I've got my coffee, so I've got some energy.
You got your coffee, and we're just psyched to go. And do we have a contestant?
Yes, we do.
And who are you?
I'm Taylor. I'm from Elizabethton, Tennessee, just down the road.
Elizabethton, Tennessee. Ooh. Wow, and that is quite near Johnson City, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Just 10, 15 minutes down the road from where you're at right now.
That's exactly right. Well, tremendous. Thanks for calling, Taylor. Now, let's go to Kelly. And Kelly, what question do you have for Taylor from
All
Elizabethan?
Right. Yeah, Taylor, I have a question for you regarding the First Amendment.
Oh.
Ooh.
I don't know if he likes that, but go on.
All right. I think this is going to be an easier one. I'm told that I've been too hard recently on all of our
You are a hard
our
woman.
Our listeners. So we'll see, Taylor.
You.
We're going to see if you can
Let's
get this.
Let's hope it is easy.
The First Amendment protects what? A, the freedom of religion, speech, and the press. B, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, and petitioning of the government. C, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, and revolution, or D, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, revolution, and petitioning of government.
Oh, excellent. I think it's B.
Well, hold on just a second here. I can't even keep these darn things straight. In fact, I'm going to suggest we give these people pen and paper, or they should bring pen and paper when they do this, just to keep these things straight.
Get your paper out.
Yeah, I've got my pen now. Okay, now what are those choices again? What is the First Amendment protects what?
Freedom of religion, speech, and the press.
Okay, well, let's go through them one at a time, and then we'll ask Taylor to pick which one he likes or doesn't like as we go through them. What was A again?
The freedom of religion, speech, and the press.
How about that one, Taylor?
Well, I like that one, but I think it's lacking a couple of the other elements. I believe there might be five.
Okay, well, what is B then?
B was the freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and petitioning of government.
There's five. Is that the one you like, Taylor?
That's the one I liked originally, but I'm glad I heard it again to make sure that it did have all the elements I thought were supposed to be included.
Okay, well, what about C?
C, here's another five rights for you. Freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and revolution.
Ah, the right of revolution. Okay. What about that one, Taylor?
Well, I don't believe you have a right to revolution, but...
That's no fun.
What's that song, yeah, The Revolution song?
Yeah.
Talking about revolution? I'm not going to sing.
Sing!
No.
Okay. What about that one, Taylor?
I don't believe there's a right to revolution, and I still like B the best.
Like B. Okay, well, what about D?
All right. Freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, revolution, and petitioning the government.
That's D.
D. Oh, I'm sorry, that was D.
Four of the five I agree with, but it's got the revolution in there, and I'm going to have to stick with B.
Okay. B is your final answer. And one last time, Kelly, what was B?
Religion, speech, press, assembly, and petitioning the government.
Final answer, Taylor?
Oh, I guess. Final answer.
He doesn't sound sure of himself. Okay, that's Taylor's final answer, B. What is it, Kelly?
Well, congratulations! Hey. Ding, 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 ding!
Congratulations, Taylor.
For our listeners out there, Amendment 1 actually reads and protects those exact five rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Yes, and those are extremely important. And in fact, I think I saw a recent poll where most Americans had no idea even how many freedoms were protected by the First Amendment. But those are sometimes called our first freedoms because they're in the First Amendment. And it's not just speech, which is extraordinarily important. It's not just religion, but petitioning the government, extremely important as well, and assembly.
Absolutely.
You know, getting together with other people and having meetings. And, those are all very important things, and there have been some very important cases about them. So, Taylor, congratulations to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Harris.
Absolutely. And you make sure and we'll get you your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
Excellent. Well,
wear
thank
it
you
with
all
pride.
So much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Brad Rourke, a very interesting fellow whom I met recently at a Kettering Foundation conference held at the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. We've been talking a lot about political participation, or what Brad calls deliberative democracy. We'll finish up our discussion on that, and then maybe we'll talk to someone from the Center for the Constitution. In fact, the fellow who runs it, and he'll tell us why he sponsors these sorts of conferences. His name is Doug Smith, so stick around.
The problem, and hopefully not to oversimplify it, is that elites tend to become corrupted or perhaps at the very least have tunnel vision, and the great mass of people tends to become apathetic and disconnected.
Yeah, and we're complicit in that, mm-hmm. obviously. So we're not apathetic because we're somehow bad people,
mm-hmm.
But that we're all complicit in this comfortable
approach.
Wait a second,
Brad. Now I have to. I just noticed something there. You said we when I mentioned the great mass of people.
Uh-huh.
Is that how you look at yourself? I would think
it's a member of the masses.
I would look at you and say you're part of the ruling elite here. You're a part of this group. You're in Washington D.C.
Relatively few folks step forward and ever care to talk about this kind of stuff. That's true. And so, in one sense, you could say, "Yeah, I'm the elite. You're the elite, Stuart. You're a college professor."
I've always felt myself to be elite, and I've always said the only perfect form of government I know is me as king.
That's right. Would that it were true, right?
But other than that, it's just that's it. I mean, here you and I sit here. We're both very privileged people. We're privileged to be mm-hmm. sitting where we're sitting today, talking about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
We're privileged to be on the radio, and so that's also part of the problem. Is that, here we are scratching our heads saying, how do we get everybody else involved? And everybody else doesn't seem to be here at the moment.
Right. Well, I think that I'm scratching my heads and not asking how to get other people involved. But how do we get elites to bring their thinking in line with all those other people who aren't around, who aren't in the room? And, one of the pathologies here in our democracy is that institutions and elites tends to go about their work in ways that alienate other people. And so it's not a question of we need to sell democracy to the folk.
Mm-hmm.
it's actually a question of we need in corridors of power and on the radio shows and in the op-ed pages to begin to see the ways in which the dominant discourse alienates ordinary people. And so when I say we, I actually say that it's sort of a calculated political rhetorical move to say we, to mean that what we need to do as elites here, here in the grounds of Montpelier, where there literally is no one in sight. We're sitting in this farmhouse where the Constitution was imagined.
It is beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
It's gorgeous.
Even though it's raining. but we, Stuart, you and I,
mm-hmm.
need to organize our work in such a way that we know we are hearing people, not just other leaders.
And it's tougher and tougher the further that you and I and others who are privileged to be here, the further and further we get away.
It's a discipline.
It is something, it's a perspective that I guess one really has to struggle for.
Well, wasn't that fascinating? I really enjoyed speaking with Brad. In fact, I enjoyed the entire conference sponsored by the Kettering Foundation and held at the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. These sort of things happen all the time there, as I recently discussed with the executive director of the Center for the Constitution, Doug Smith.
We're sitting in the Nerve Center right now. This is Lewis Hall. This is where the Center for the Constitution is centered, right?
That's right, here at Montpelier. And Lewis Hall is really where the administration of Montpelier happens, but it's also the offices of the Center for the Constitution. This is an old carriage house that the DuPont family had used while they were shepherding and preserving Montpelier. And then since then, we have taken the building over. We've renovated it. And today, this is, as you say, the Nerve Center. This is where we hold all of our academic training programs, and this is where our offices are.
We're sitting in the main classroom, right?
This is the main classroom. It's fully outfitted with the most modern technology. We can pipe people in through the internet. We have screens and able to get everything wireless. It's really an amazing space. One of the things that I love, I like to think of myself as a fairly creative person. One of the things I love is no less than 40 feet of whiteboard space. And from time to time,
I'm looking at two huge whiteboards.
And from time to time, we fill them all. Mm-hmm. Because when we're developing a program, we just try to get as detailed as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Lewis Hall is not only very modern, it's not only high tech, it's also very attractive. In fact, as I look through the windows here that lead that's into the center area, you have these beautiful old leather upholstered chairs. It looks very, almost like an English gentleman's club over there. And that's by design, isn't it? You want people to be comfortable and sit down and talk to each other.
Absolutely. You know, one of the amazing things about the Center for the Constitution that I've found is that we're not only one of America's premier academic training centers on the Constitution, but because it's here at Montpelier, it actually is a place of great reflection and discernment. Mm-hmm. And so when people come to Montpelier, we want them to get an ethos of the place. This is really what led Madison to take a step back, to breathe a bit, and to develop the Constitution. We find that when learners come here, it's part retreat and part training. And so that room is really indicative of the tone we try to set, which is that we're not here to fill you full of content and hope that you go away and mimic that. We really want you discerning what the Constitution has meant and how relevant it is today.
And that segues into my next question. That pretty much is the mission of the center, isn't it? Is to bring that ethos to more people, to educate them.
That's exactly right. We know how important it is to have academic conversations about the U.S. Constitution and even compare and show divergence with other constitutions. For me personally, while I appreciate those academic conversations, I also want us to become a popular gateway. I want people to have kitchen table conversations about the values that are in the U.S. Constitution because they were important 225 years ago, but they're equally as important today.
Yeah, and that's a mission we share, both with this radio show and the center. That's so important. I mean, it's important to have people who spend their lives studying the Constitution talk to each other, but that only goes so far. It's a Constitution for all of us. It belongs to all of us, and we all need to understand it. And I would say it's not just Lewis Hall, but it is the entire constitutional village here, which seems almost designed for that sort of reflection. There's a series of these lovely old farm buildings in the guest houses where I've been staying the last couple of days. Each one of them, of course, has private rooms and baths, but then you have these common areas that are very comfortably furnished. And I imagine that's what happens to a lot of your seminar attendees is they're having conversations here in Lewis Hall, they're having conversations in their individual houses with their bunk mates, if you will. They're having conversations, there are several outdoor patios I see with very comfortable outdoor furniture. This is a place. It's almost Socratic, you know, in its whole atmosphere. You know, this you can almost imagine these wise men just circulating around and throwing out ideas.
Absolutely, and any time that you can have women and men come together and to take a pause, to take a breath, and have deep and meaningful conversations about something as important and overarching as the U.S. Constitution, there's a benefit there. And what we found in our history for the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier is that because we are really bringing in teachers, cops, elected officials, you know, because we're bringing in those professions that have a significant impact on society at large, our impact actually isn't just with those individuals. It's not a conference where everyone in the room gets something out of it, but they're actually taking something home. They're taking those values, a deeper understanding of sovereignty and self-governance and balance in government. They're taking those and they are incorporating and teaching others, and that's really where the power comes in.
That's so important too, and certainly there's the teaching aspect to it. I mean, you get a lot of leverage with those groups you mentioned. One in particular really strikes me as a great group to be educating, and you don't often think of this, and that's cops. Earlier this morning for the Bill of Rights course, I was in a video session with the Chief of Police of Charlottesville. And I was very pleased to see him there, because, and I'm very pleased to think that other police officers come here, because those are the guys with the badges and the guns, and they're implementing the Constitution every day. Every day. And for them to actually take a moment and come here and have a retreat and think about what they're doing, I think that's incredibly important.
You know, police officers, enforcement agencies, they take the Constitution incredibly seriously.
Yes.
As you say, they are protectors of the Constitution. They are purveyors of constitutional values. And they, like all of us, realize that we need a good brushing up on our constitutional understanding from time to time. And so one of our programs actually is to reach out to cops and sheriffs and police officers and really helping them to be reflective and to understand that we know how important the Constitution is to them, and we know that they have to carry that Constitution into their lives every single day.
They do, and they're the first line. I mean, sure, we tend to think of the Constitution and the judges will protect us, right? Well, every day there's a cop out there who has a choice whether to violate your Fourth Amendment rights or whether to uphold the Constitution. And sometimes, I'm sure, well-intentioned cops violate the Constitution just because they don't really understand it. And somebody who comes here is much less likely, I would think, to do something like that. And now, how would a police officer, a police chief, or a teacher, how would they initiate the process of getting one of these seminars for themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually, several times a year, have programs just for cops. A lot of our residential courses, and of course our online courses, are available to anyone all the time. They're free. We have several residential courses that are open to the public, but when we have the COPS course, that's very much a closed course. Mm-hmm. We invite police officers to come in, we have prosecutors come in, defense attorneys, and chiefs of police who have a legal background, and they train these cops, and they really provoke them to have a deeper understanding of the Constitution. Really, you can find that on our website. Mm-hmm. Montpelier.org/center. To be honest with you, if there's a particular group or agency of police officers around the country that's interested in having us come in, we can do a residential program as well.
You'll actually send people out.
For yeah. Cops, we will, most certainly. Yeah.
That's remarkable. Now, what sort of cost are we talking about? If I'm a police chief and I say, yeah, I'd like to go to Montpelier for 3 days with my force and bring in a dozen officers, mm-hmm. what's it going to cost them?
Well, we're obviously going to work within a training budget of what that force is. We don't really want to turn anyone away, particularly those who are so important to the public safety and public good.
So no one should hesitate to call you and to be upfront with you about how much money they have. You'll try to work with them.
We will. And what we'll do is we'll work with that the chief of police in that area or the sheriff. We'll determine what the capacity is. We'll bring in appropriate scholars to help. And then really what we're looking for is, you know, to make sure the scholars stay whole and that travel budget. But the important thing is, for us, it's not a business, it's a mission. Mm-hmm. You know, we definitely run the organization very fiscally sound, but we're a mission organization, and we want to see groups like COPS talking about and getting brushed up or better able to feel like they have a handle on the U.S. Constitution.
That's marvelous. Going to the opposite end of the spectrum, though, the people who do look at this from the courtroom or from an academic perspective, I was surprised recently. I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised when I was speaking with one of the trustees at the Appalachian School of Law, Elizabeth McClanahan, who is a justice on the Virginia Supreme Court.
And I mentioned Montpelier, and she said, oh, I love Montpelier. And she went on about it. She said, you know, we have a retreat there every year. And I did not know that. So you have the Virginia Supreme Court come here en masse and yeah. talk to you about the Constitution. Now, that's a very influential group.
You know, that goes back to my point a little earlier. There are groups that we talk about being here and groups that we don't speak that much about being here, but they certainly come in. We like to think of ourselves as a place where people can come and explore, retreat, and study. And so there have been groups like the Virginia Supreme Court that have come in, and we always have that space available for groups like that.
So any Supreme Court justices out there, give Doug a call, and he will make sure you're all tuned up on the U.S. Constitution.
We'll get you tuned up, I tell you. You know, sometimes we even have, you know, we'll have an author who's working on a book on the Constitution or a book on James Madison. We make sure that there's room at the end for them. We want people to have Montpelier top in their mind as a place to retreat, to discern, and to really go deeper on the U.S. Constitution.
And in order to aid them in that endeavor, not only do you have these wonderful accommodations, these wonderful facilities, this beautiful setting, it's so pastoral and peaceful, you also have something that I absolutely adore, and that is no televisions. There are no televisions in the Constitutional Village, and that's forewarning for all of you ESPN addicts out there, but I find that to be one of the best things because you don't have the level of distraction you would. You're almost forced to come out of your room and interact with the other people who are here. Now, you do have, I will say, wireless internet. That's a compromise with reality. I don't know how I feel about that. I kind of wish you didn't. I use it when I'm here, but with that caveat, this is a place to interact with other people face to face.
Yeah, and you know, that's just really keeping with James and Dolly Madison.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, James and Dolly Madison had some of the world's most influential people from the 19th century come by. I mean, the Marquis de Lafayette,
mm-hmm.
Jackson, Monroe, I mean, Jefferson. You know,
right, yeah.
This was a country estate. You know, this was the farm of the Madisons, and it was a place that was a destination. People would come here. Now, of course, in the 19th century, you might have folks come for a day, a week, a month.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone knew this as Mr. Madison's place, and the kind of reflection that happens here is likely what drove his ability to create the Virginia Plan and to architect the Constitution mm-hmm. and to be the main author of the Bill of Rights. And so this is something that we continue to promote and to preserve, and I think it works well for people.
Just a squirrel's leap from heaven. Here at Montpelier. Well, Doug Smith, anything else you want to add about the Center for the Constitution or about Montpelier before we go?
No. Love for folks to check us out online, and we would really love to see folks anytime.
That's Montpelier. It's MONTPELIER.org, right?
.org, yep.
And then they'll be able to find all this good stuff. Well, Doug Smith, Executive Director of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Stuart.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. After the break, we'll have our This Week at Montpelier, and then we'll go back and speak some more to Brad Rourke, who's going to talk to us about another important subject, ethics. Stay tuned.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Well, Kelly Carmichael, I almost hesitate to ask what's happening this week at Montpelier because I just see this pile of papers in front of you. I think you have a lot to say, don't you?
Well, we're very excited. It is the biggest week of the year.
Why is it the biggest week of the year?
It's even more exciting than the Tooth Fairy coming to your home.
It's even more, is it really?
It's more exciting than the Easter Bunny.
It's more exciting than the Easter Bunny. What is happening? Why is this week so special?
This is Constitution Week. We celebrate Constitution Week in commemoration of Constitution Day, September 17th, 1787.
I just thought up a slogan. Constitution Week, because one day is not enough.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. There so we celebrate the whole week. Yeah. What's going on in Constitution Week at Montpelier?
Well, to commemorate September 17th, 1787, when our framers signed the Constitution, we have a number of events that will take place both at James Madison's Montpelier in Orange, Virginia, and in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
One of our big events that we host annually is the Clodmore Lecture Series, and we pick a topic each year, and we have a conference up in Washington, D.C., and that's one of our biggest offsite events that we host. And this year, on Wednesday, September 19th, we will be at the National Archives doing a session on the War of 1812 and how the implications of the War of 1812 really was our first test of our Constitution's sustainability.
Yeah, it certainly was. It was the first war we had after the Revolution of any significance. The little skirmishes here and there, and it was, of course, of paramount importance to James Madison, who was in office at that time, that the war be conducted effectively and constitutionally. And so that's going to be what you all are talking about then, huh?
Absolutely. And you'd be interested to hear that Roger Mudd will be our moderator.
Roger Mudd of CBS News fame?
Yes.
Well, he's
delighted to have him.
Absolutely. I'm sure he'll do a fine job, too.
Yes, absolutely. So folks do need to RSVP for this one in advance, and you can find out more information about the program at montpelier.org.
Montpelier.org, and follow the links to the Claude Moore Lecture, and then they do need to RSVP if they want to come. But is there any charge for it?
There is no charge. It is free, but because there's limited seating at the National Archives, we do have to limit the RSVPs, so first come, first serve.
Absolutely. So get online, folks, and RSVP for the Claude Moore Lecture. Okay, what else is happening this week?
Well, the very next day, on Thursday, September 20th, we will be doing a program in partnership with the Constitution Project in Georgetown Law called Constitution Day 2012, Plugging National Security Leaks While Preserving Free Speech.
Wow, from the War of 1812 to...
Something very current.
Very current. A 2012 issue and a very important issue, of course. There's been all that criticism of the alleged leaks from the Obama administration about national security.
Absolutely.
And I understand that the Obama administration has been very aggressive in many respects in prosecuting cases of leaks, even at the same time as it's being criticized for leaking too much. But there's always a free speech issue there. So that'll be a fascinating topic to talk about as well.
Yeah. Okay. And that will take place at Georgetown Law School.
Which is right on Capitol Hill, right?
Absolutely. It's right on, really close to Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And the session will go from 9 to 12 p.m., and questions that will...
That is, well, p.m. or a.m.?
A.m.
A.m., a.m., okay, in the morning. Okay, good. I was thinking, 9 to
12. 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., yes, in the morning session.
Now I see, 9 in the morning till 12
Not 12 a.m.
Okay, got it. Okay, good. All right, now that'll be interesting as well, okay.
Yeah.
And that's the second of the three, do they need to RSVP for that as well, or is
Do you need to RSVP, and if you go to constitutionday2012.eventbrite.com, you can find out more information, or go to center.montpelier.org.
So once again, they can find out what they need here at Montpelier, and then go from there. Okay.
And if that wasn't enough, the week is not over yet. We have what's now becoming our annual celebration of Constitution Day. On the 4th of July, we have fireworks. Can't think of anything better to do than to celebrate the Constitution, than have fireworks to celebrate our Constitution. So
indeed.
Saturday, September 22nd, we will celebrate Constitution Day at James and Dolly Madison's home.
Right. And now, the 17th is technically Constitution Day, but of course, that's the first Saturday following it, so that's an appropriate day to get people out here. Okay, so what all is going to go on here on Constitution Day?
Well, fun for everyone, family and all. There'll be tethered balloon rides, food, fireworks. James and Dolly Madison will be here. The U.S. Navy band will be coming. We'll have a jazz ensemble. Will be just a really fun event. It was a great event last year. It's now going to become a tradition for us here at Montpelier.
Just a minute. Now, there are a couple things in there that sound a little incongruous, but I think maybe I know why you put them in there. Now, first of all, the tethered balloon ride sounds extremely cool. Do you mean you can have hot air balloons and people actually get to get in them, but they're not going to float away. They're just going to float up above Montpelier and then be pulled back down.
Yes.
That's a relatively tame way.
Unless we put you in the balloon, then we
and
might.
And then you can just cut the tether and let you go. That's one way to get rid of me. No, but that would be lovely. I mean, then you'd get the bird's eye view of the area. That's a cool thing. The other thing that struck me is a jazz band. Now, at first, you might not think of jazz as sort of a patriotic exercise, but then as soon as I thought that, I thought, no. That is the one original form of American music. That's very patriotic.
And they will be playing patriotic tunes while they're here. So we're,
patriotic we're... jazz band. That sounds tremendous. All right.
Yep. There will be some admission fees for folks coming. It's $10 per car, $5 per car, $5 for anyone who's an Orange County resident. And the gates during that day open at 9 a.m., so you can really come and spend your entire day with us on Saturday, this 22nd of September.
And there'll be lots of vendors and things, so there's lots of food and drink and people can get. And they can do all the usual Montpelier things, plus all this sort of a festival atmosphere.
It'll be a great festival.
Oh, that would be a wonderful thing to do.
And it's not in the heat of July.
Yeah, it is, actually.
It's not during the big storm that came through during the 4th of July last year.
Let's hope for some good weather.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, if you're up in the balloon. No, that sounds like an absolutely marvelous thing. And if I heard you correctly, the charge is per car, so you can cram 15 or 20 of your closest friends into the Pinto station wagon.
I'm picturing a lot of clown cars pulling through.
Absolutely. That's the best way to bring your buds. All right. Well, that sounds wonderful. Is that it for Constitution Week,
That is it for Constitution Week, though. I encourage everyone during Constitution Week, pick up your Constitution or come to learn.montpelier.org and take one of our Constitution courses that we have.
Absolutely. That's always a good way to celebrate the Constitution, but maybe this is especially a good time to do it. Well, thanks very much, Kelly. Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and now it's time for us to speak a little bit more with Brad Rourke about ethics.
Well, you mentioned another subject that I know you've got a great interest in, and that, of course, is ethics in government. So could we shift the focus slightly and just talk a little bit about that and why that's such an interest of yours?
It is. I'd love to shift the focus, and I always love to shift the focus.
Okay.
If you know Myers-Briggs, I'm a very strong P, so, you know.
What is that?
It means I'm distracted by bright, shiny objects. So if you throw a new conversational subject in, I'll gladly take a run at it.
All right.
But yeah, one of the things I've done with my career is work in the field of ethics and public life, and I did some time working at a think tank about ethics called the Institute for Global Ethics in Camden, Maine. And have developed with the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at University of Virginia a candidate training program that's rooted in ethics, that starts and ends in ethics, and is designed to develop sort of a different type of political candidate, one that thinks about not where does the law say the lines are, because actually when it comes to campaigning, the law says the lines are very few. For reasonable and understandable reasons that have to do with the First Amendment and other things.
You don't pick easy issues, do you, Brad?
No, I'm a chaotic
participation and reformation of our political system to get participation ratcheted up or ethics in government. Two of the most intractable problems
that I can think of. Well, I'll go you one better, actually. So there's the ethics training piece that I was beginning to talk about, but if you want to talk about difficult, I'll tell you about a project that I was a part of that I actually have some sad learning from, which is when I was at the Institute for Global Ethics, one of the things we did was we tried to get candidates for office for Congress to sit down with one another and negotiate codes of conduct with one another that would govern how they would run their campaigns in an effort to reduce negative campaigning. And if you want to talk about thankless, difficult work that in the end you question the utility of and the value of, that would be it.
Yeah, that is an awfully difficult thing, but I have to ask
negative
you...
Negative campaigning.
Well, I have to ask you a definitional question now. Now, when you say negative, do you mean personal ad hominem attacks that are perhaps less than accurate or that tend to demonize your opponent? Is that the sort of negative you're talking about? Or are you simply talking about ads that contrast the positions of two candidates and, you know, in a civil manner say, I believe I'm more qualified than my opponent for these reasons?
You've actually put your finger on one of the many problems of any kind of effort like the one I just described, which is, and it relates to our earlier conversation about political elites and leadership, that political elites, in this case, campaign consultants, campaign workers and candidates, have a different definition of negative than ordinary people do. And we have a great deal of polling data that demonstrates this, great deal of research, it's well documented. Folks in politics think when they hear negative, they think, oh, that means if I say anything critical of the opponent. And so when they hear some well-meaning do-good organization say we want to try to ratchet down negative campaigning, what they hear incorrectly is, we're telling you, candidates, that you cannot say anything bad about your opponent, which is not true. Contrast that with what people think. When you talk to ordinary voters or even non-voters about negative campaigning, what they mean is what you said, Stuart, which is nasty, unfair, ad hominem, irrelevant, and
coarse. Okay, Brad, well, we're going to run out of time here in a few minutes, so what are the solutions here? Now, you take your pick. How do we get more people involved in government, and how do we do so ethically? In 25 words or less.
I think I'm going to pick ethics.
Okay.
And I'm going to say that the answer to these questions is for us to develop and use a more robust language of ethics to be able to talk about it in public life in a way that we haven't been able to. When it was the case that most of us went to church in a homogeneous fashion, we had a language. I'm not saying that it was a good thing that we all went to church, but it did provide us with a language. Now, because of that, when we talk about ethics, people who are secular and people who are churchgoers hear moralizing, sermonizing, preaching. What we need is a secular language of ethics that allows us to talk about right and wrong, that in a way that is amenable to the public square. And I think that when we can begin to do that, and we can begin to talk about right and wrong, not just effective and ineffective, and not just right and left, we'll begin to go a long way towards being able to call out the kinds of behaviors we'd rather not see. That is one answer.
So we have to develop a secular moral framework that we can then, it will be our baseline. And and when we see people going outside those lines, then we can say, hey, get back in line.
And on another show, I can go into half an hour about how we really can do that, in my opinion.
That is a huge challenge. Well, at least you're not going to have difficulty finding work for the next few decades.
That's right. Getting people to pay for it is another matter. But
of course.
I've got the tasks laid out.
Always an issue. Well, Brad Rourke of the Manicky Circle Group, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Thank you very kindly for taking time to talk to us today. We appreciate it. And it's just as a final thought, I mean, we talk about the Constitution here and certainly, you know, how it was adopted and how it's developed in the major court cases. But ultimately, it is itself a framework.
Yes.
And we have to then use that framework to govern ourselves. And that's really what we've been talking about today, is how do we best operate within that framework to actually govern ourselves.
That's right. We've got an operating system. How do we use it?
Thanks very much, Brad. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to Brad Rourke of the Manicky Circle Group and the Kettering Foundation. Thanks also to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson, and to our distribution engineers, Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.